from 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the message from the state's transportation secretary on the coming Commonwealth Avenue Bridge project.
Stay away. If you don't need to be here, don't come anywhere near the area.
Also, the continuing debate on the Senate health care bill from Republican Mitch McConnell.
Any senator who votes against starting debate is telling America that you're just fine with the Obamacare nightmare.
To Democrat Chuck Schumer.
A vote in favor of the motion to proceed will be permission, a permission slip to slash Medicaid, hurt millions, and raise taxes on the wealthy.
Also today, a new study from Boston University on the prevalence of brain disease and former football players.
We've got sort of a fraternity of players who just, you know, call each other up and wherever we need it, and for lack of a better phrase, talk each other off the ledge.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We're awaiting a joint press conference between President Donald Trump and Lebanon's Prime Minister Saad Hariri, and we'll bring it to you live as soon as it begins. But first, we want to check in on a construction project that's going to create a traffic nightmare for tens of thousands of people in Greater Boston. The Commonwealth Avenue Bridge Project begins in earnest this week, and joining us to talk about this is Massachusetts Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack. Secretary Pollack, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So this morning, during a press conference about this project, you said that you would like to hang a giant sign from a crane near the Commonwealth Avenue Bridge project that says, flee. How bad is it going to be?
I think it's going to be pretty hellish for commuters if they don't avoid the area. It's one of the most complicated intersections of different kinds of transportation infrastructure anywhere in the Commonwealth, where Commonwealth Avenue goes over the Mass Pike. So you have the Mass Pike and Commonwealth Avenue. Next to the Mass Pike, you have tracks for commuter rail and Amtrak. Up on Commonwealth Avenue, you have, of course, the Green Line, mm-hmm. and a lot of bicyclists and pedestrians. Mm-hmm. So all of those are affected by this project.
Right. So when do things start to close?
So things actually start to close tomorrow at 9 p.m. when we are going to start busing the B branch of the Green Line on Commonwealth Avenue in order to begin to take down the catenary wires and pull up the rails, all of which will be replaced as we do the Commonwealth Avenue Bridge. So Wednesday night, we start on the Green Line. Then Thursday night, we close the BU Bridge to everything except people walking, biking, and emergency vehicles and buses. Also Thursday night, we close Commonwealth Avenue itself on the eastbound side. So folks coming east on Commonwealth Avenue are coming in towards Boston are going to be diverted off the street between at Packard's Corner, and they're not going to be able to get back on Commonwealth Avenue until Kenmore Square. So this week, most of the diversions are going to be put in place, and then there's the turnpike as well. So people will really start to see the project by Thursday and Friday.
And aside from the T's Green Line B branch, there's also the commuter rail, and you mentioned earlier Amtrak. This is all affected, right?
Everything's affected. Now, the commuter rail, we will run during the week. We actually encourage folks who might normally drive on the Mass Pike to consider trying the Worcester-Framingham line on the commuter rail. You don't have to have a pass. Might not be a bad idea to download some schedules and a free app that allows you to pay, but the commuter rail and Amtrak only close on weekends. They're there during the week for the people who might want to avoid the Mass Pike, which will be reduced to two lanes, and eventually the whole Mass Pike in both directions is going to have to fit into three lanes on one side of the highway.
What about pedestrians and cyclists?
So we know that Commonwealth Avenue is a really important route for people who are walking and biking, and also the Green Line closure, it's actually only a little less than a mile, the distance that we have to close down the Green Line. So we want people to walk and bike, and so we will actually build a separate bike lane for folks on the westbound side of Commonwealth Avenue, and the sidewalks will be open. So people will be able to walk and bike along Commonwealth Avenue and over the BU Bridge.
Which drivers commuters do you think are going to have it the worst?
Oh, I don't want to predict who's going to have it the worst. I live just west of Boston, and so I know this area pretty well. I think the Pike is going to be really challenging for people.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, in a way, think that our Mass Pike users maybe know a little bit more about what's coming because we've been trying to reach out to them with variable message signs and through the Easy Pass program. I worry that a lot of people aren't going to realize that we're closing a good-sized chunk of Commonwealth Avenue until after we do it.
Hmm. How long is this project going to take, and when do you think things are going to open up?
So the schedule is to have everything 100% done and back open for the morning rush hour on Monday, August 14th. So it's about a three-week project.
That sounds incredibly, incredibly fast. I mean, I'm sure there are people rolling their eyes saying, you know, Secretary, we heard this about the Big Dig, too.
So one of the things that we and a lot of other states have learned a lot about is what's called accelerated bridge replacement. So the idea is that you literally basically build the bridge and then just move it into place. So if folks happen to pass the old Beacon Park Yards rail yard on the Mass Pike and were to glance over right now, you would actually see essentially the Commonwealth Avenue Bridge sitting there in the form of a couple hundred precast pieces of concrete and 40-plus steel girders, and it's literally been sort of put together over there, and there's a big red crane that you see if you drive on the Pike, and what's going to happen is one piece at a time we'll tear down the bridge, and then they'll put it all back together. There'll be up to 200 people at a time working on the project 24/7 during this period, and good financial incentives built into the contractor's contract to get them done on time. So it's still a relatively new idea, but it's been used successfully here in Massachusetts and other places, and we are very confident of our ability to deliver this project. It's 3 weeks this summer. Now it's another 3 weeks next summer when we need to do the westbound side of Commonwealth Ave, but that's way better than what could have literally been 4 or 5 years of constant construction.
What's the total estimated cost?
So it's about an $80 million project, which ironically in the scheme of transportation and especially in sort of Big Dig terms is not a lot of dollars. I think what makes the project so prominent for us is its complexity and the way it impacts pretty much every mode of transportation more than the dollar amount.
If, say, there are any delays for a variety of reasons, you know, things happen with construction, what do you think might happen there? Would you put it off, or would you just plow through?
No, we'll get the project done. We really need to get the eastbound side finished up this summer. We've picked the end of July and August because it is a lower traffic time, and there's actually lower ridership on the Green Line, as you can imagine. We've worked with BU to make sure that there's not much going on campus during this time. And we know that we need to get done on time and finish up because, of course, students are all coming back, and traffic ticks up and school reopens, and that's why we're so committed to finishing it up and getting out of everybody's way by Monday, August 14th.
What's your main advice to folks, particularly regular commuters to the area, aside from flee?
it pretty much comes down to three things. Number one is stay away. If you don't need to be in that part of town, don't. Number two is if you do have to be there, plan ahead. Figure out, are you going to take the bus shuttle? Are you going to walk? What are you going to do when they take you off Comm Ave? And then number three is just leave plenty of time because it's going to take longer if you choose to drive where you can drive or if you're on the Green Line.
Okay. Massachusetts Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And there's more information about the Commonwealth Avenue Bridge project at our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We are awaiting a joint press conference in Washington between President Donald Trump and the Prime Minister of Lebanon, Saad Hariri. It is expected to start any moment now. And joining me to analyze this and what happens at this press conference and also what's happening in Washington today with the healthcare vote is Matt Visor, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Matt, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So tell us, what do we expected first to hear during this press conference?
Well, I think there's a lot of open questions for the president. Probably first out of the gate is we are just having breaking news around the healthcare debate is going to proceed in
right.
the Senate.
We know a 50-50 vote, or a 50-51 vote with 51. Vice President Pence actually breaking the tie there.
Yeah, so I imagine that he will crow about that. I mean, it is an accomplishment for Republicans to get to that point. Lots of work ahead, obviously, on that. The other open question for the president is his faith in his attorney general, Jeff Sessions. He's been very critical of Jeff Sessions over the last few days, and has yet to sort of be asked about that in a public setting. So I think those are the issues that probably we'll be looking to hear from the president on shortly.
Mm-hmm. And do you think we'll also hear about some of the outstanding issues with Lebanon as well?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, obviously he'll be there, but there's an awful lot happening domestically, you know, at the moment. And in these press conferences, there's two questions to American reporters, two questions to foreign reporters, typically. So you imagine that maybe some of the more focused on the foreign affairs may come from the other side today.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, so far, when you think of what's happened with health care, you did say the president's likely to consider this a victory, and it is a victory to a certain degree. But explain to our listeners, this is just one step in a long process on repealing and replacing Obamacare, correct?
Right. This is It was a procedural vote today, allowing the drama to continue. You know, if it had gone down, then the health care bill would not have proceeded at all in any form. There's still huge questions over what is going to happen with the health care bill, or even what form it's going to take. This allows the process to continue. They may try first for a straight repeal of the Affordable Care Act, and then if that doesn't pass, they may proceed to other things, including the House legislation. But at this point, there's probably not 50 votes for any of those scenarios, so there's still a lot of work to be done. Some of that will be seen publicly on the Senate floor, a lot of that privately with some arm twisting, probably in the office of Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader.
Arizona Senator John McCain came back today for this first procedural vote and also made a speech on the floor of the Senate. How did he look? What did he say?
Well, he's still speaking right now, and he did make it back. He cast the second-to-last vote, giving Republicans the votes that they needed. He looks good. You know, I mean, he has a scar above his eye where the surgery was done, but dressed up, looks like the feisty John McCain that so many of us have known so well. He's speaking now and talking about bipartisanship and kind of delivering a more statesmanlike speech to the Senate and imploring his fellow senators to sort of put their differences aside, which in this atmosphere we know is not easy, and it's a very divided place. But John McCain is speaking over his decades of experience in this chamber and confessing himself, you know, not always living up to that standard. So he's kind of giving an emotional speech. Is planning to have a press conference following this as the speech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we should say all of the Democratic senators and Republicans, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, voted no on the motion to proceed. And there were protesters in the gallery as well, and they broke out in a chant of kill the bill and shame. We have a little bit of tape of that and of Senate Leader Mitch McConnell. Let's listen.
Ask for the ayes and nays.
Ask for the ayes and
nays.
Sergeant Arms will restore order in the chamber.
Those are protesters chanting during the Senate vote today on the health care overhaul bill. Matt Beiser, how raucous was that?
Well, you don't hear that a lot of times. I mean, the Senate chamber is just like the debate and the tenor of the room overall is much more austere than the House chamber. So you don't hear chants like that. It is open to the public. There's an upper area for seating for the public. Anybody can wait in line and go in and sit down. But it is rare to hear chants and interruptions of Senate debate. So it was a rare moment, and illustrates, I think, the tenor overall of the healthcare debate and the emotions around what the Senate is, at least taking a step toward today in continuing to debate taking away health insurance.
You know, earlier today, our own senator here from Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren, put up a video on Twitter urging people to do everything they could to oppose the bill. Let's listen to what she had to say.
This is not a drill. The Republicans are about to take us to the floor to vote on going forward on something that they're calling a health care bill. Now, I say something because nobody's read it. Nobody knows what's in it. But they want to go to the floor and start so they will be able to pass a repeal of the Affordable Care Act.
So Elizabeth Warren, of course, again, critical of the Republican health care overhaul bill that went before the Senate today and actually made it through the procedural vote to proceed on repealing and replacing Obamacare. Any surprises there? Not really, huh, Matt Beiser?
Not coming from Senator Warren, who's adamantly opposed to taking away or, repealing the Affordable Care Act. But, she does have a point in that there's been very little debate. We don't know even at this minute. The senators themselves don't know what exactly they're going to be voting on next. So they're voting to proceed on a debate that nobody knows what direction it will take, which is striking, especially in the Senate, where there, are a lot of times a lot of hearings, some of them very tedious, different experts testifying. Usually the end result of legislation is comes at the end of a very long process. In this case, it feels slapped together, very quickly, and people don't exactly know where it's going to head. So I think in that respect, you'll hear Democrats a lot talk about that and the process, which is a little bit ironic given that Republicans had similar critiques of Democrats for the secretive nature of passing the Affordable Care Act in the first place.
I just want to remind our listeners, we're talking with Matt Beiser of the Boston Globe. We are awaiting a joint press conference between President Donald Trump and Lebanon's Prime Minister Saad Hariri. We will bring it to you as soon as it begins. John McCain just finished speaking on the Senate floor after the vote today where the Senate did make that procedural vote to proceed with repealing and replacing Obamacare. Matt Beiser, tell us about some of the holdouts here until the very last minute. It was really just before the vote that we heard from some senators that, yes, in fact, they were going to proceed. West Virginia senator in particular did say, yes, I'll allow this vote to go forward. But as you mentioned, they don't know what's coming up after this vote. So we don't know exactly where they're going to stand from here. Can you tell us about the sort of last minute turnaround there?
Yeah, and there has been a couple of senators who have been particularly outspoken, and that includes Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski and Shelley Moore Capito from West Virginia. Mm-hmm. And she is the one that changed a little bit. Murkowski and Collins both stayed no's on this motion today, whereas Capito agreed to let debate go forward. Earlier, she had said she would not do that unless she knew what the outcome would be.
Matt, I'm just going to interrupt you now because we are going to go to the president, who is about to begin this press conference with Lebanon's Prime Minister Saad Hariri.
To announce that with zero of the Democrats' votes, the motion to proceed on health care has just passed. And now we move forward towards truly great health care for the American people. We look forward to that. This was a big step. I want to thank Senator John McCain, very brave man. He made a tough trip to get here and vote. So we want to thank Senator McCain and all of the Republicans. We passed it without one Democrat vote. And that's a shame, but that's the way it is, and it's very unfortunate. But I want to congratulate American people, because we're going to give you great health care. And we're going to get rid of Obamacare, which should have been, frankly, terminated long ago. It's been a disaster for the American people. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, and thank you all for being here. It is my honor to welcome Prime Minister Saad Hariri of Lebanon to the White House. The Prime Minister and I have just concluded an extensive conversation about the challenges and opportunities facing Lebanon and its neighbors. Lebanon is on the front lines in the fight against ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and Hezbollah. The Lebanese people of all faiths are working together to keep their country, and you know this, and we've been discussing this at great length, their country safe and prosperous. They love their country, and they're going to keep it safe and prosperous. Mr. Prime Minister, I want to commend you and your people for standing up for humanity in a very troubled part of the world. The ties between our two countries stretch back more than a century. Long, long relationships. In 1866, American missionaries founded the American University of Beirut. Now, more than 150 years later, and with ongoing American support, this university continues to educate generations of leaders in the region. Today, our two countries seek to strengthen our relationship in many ways, including the pursuit of stability, mutual prosperity, and peace. What the Lebanese armed forces have accomplished in recent years is very impressive. In 2014, when ISIS tried to invade northern Lebanon, the Lebanese army beat them back. Since that time, the Lebanese army has been fighting continually to guard Lebanon's border and prevent ISIS and other terrorists, of which there are many, from gaining a foothold inside their country. The United States military has been proud to help in that fight and will continue to do so. America's assistance can help ensure that the Lebanese army is the only defender Lebanon needs. It's a very effective fighting force. Threats to the Lebanese people come from inside as well. Hezbollah is a menace to the Lebanese state, the Lebanese people, and the entire region. The group continues to increase its military arsenal, which threatens to start yet another conflict with Israel, constantly fighting them back. With the support of Iran, the organization is also fueling humanitarian catastrophe in Syria. Hezbollah likes to portray itself as a defender of Lebanese interests, but it's very clear that its true interests are those of itself and its sponsor, Iran. I have repeatedly emphasized that Syria's neighbors in the Middle East must take responsibility for helping Syrian refugees until they can return home and rebuild their country. The Lebanese people have led the way, accepting more Syrian refugees per capita than any other nation. It's not even close. I want to thank the Prime Minister and the Lebanese people for giving shelter to those victimized by ISIS, the Assad regime, and their supporters and sponsors, and pledge our continued support to Lebanon. Since the start of the Syrian crisis, the United States has helped Lebanon support Syrian refugees with clean water, food, shelter, and health care. Our approach, supporting the humanitarian needs of displaced Syrian citizens as close to their home country as possible, is the best way to help most people. America is proud to stand with those who have the courage to stand up to terrorism and take responsibility for affairs in their own region. The reliance and resilience of the Lebanese people in the face of war and terror is extraordinary. We honor the citizens of Lebanon who are working to secure a future of peace,
stability and prosperity for their children. Mr. Prime Minister, I'm grateful that you're here today. It's a big day in our country because of the vote that you just heard about. We stood and watched the results on television before coming out, and you found it very interesting, I hope.
Yes, I did.
And very important. I look forward to working with you to strengthen our partnership and the enduring friendship between the American and Lebanese peoples. Thank you very much, Mr. Prime Minister.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I had the honor and pleasure to hold a very good meeting with President Trump. I appreciate his leadership and the United States' leadership in the world today. We discussed the situation in our region and the efforts we in Lebanon are making to safeguard our political and economic stability while combating terrorism. I thank President Trump for his support to our army and security agencies, as well as his support to UNIFIL maintaining peace and stability along our southern border, where our government is committed to the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1701, as well as all resolutions. We also discussed the pressures Lebanon is facing as a result of 1.5 million Syrian displaced in our country. I outlined to the President Trump my government vision for dealing with this crisis with the support of the international community. We also discussed economic prospects in Lebanon and our government's effort to jumpstart inclusive economic growth with a particular emphasis on job creation. I thank President Trump and the United States of America for their support to the Lebanese people, striving to keep their country a model of moderation, dialogue, coexistence, and democratic governance in our region. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Margaret Talev, please.
Thank you.
Hello, Margaret.
Hi, Mr. President. Mr. Prime Minister, I'll have a question for you also in just a second, if you'll bear with me. You spoke earlier today of the Wall Street Journal. We've all seen those comments, but I think everybody here probably is hoping that you could talk a little bit more about this. You have called your Attorney General beleaguered. You've criticized his decision to recuse himself on the Russia matters. And your kind of catchphrase or motto before the White House was, "You're fired." So I'm wondering if you would talk to us a little bit about whether you've lost confidence in Jeff Sessions, whether you want him to resign on his own, whether you're prepared to fire him if he doesn't, and why you're sort of letting him twist in the wind rather than just making the call for him. Thank you.
Well, I don't think I am doing that, but I am disappointed in the Attorney General. He should not have recused himself almost immediately after he took office. And if he was going to recuse himself, he should have told me prior to taking office, and I would have quite simply picked somebody else. So I think that's a bad thing, not for the president, but for the presidency. I think it's unfair to the presidency, and that's the way I feel. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Prime Minister, could you tell us what you think about the Saudi-led blockade of Qatar? This is something that has been of great concern to the U.S. also in terms of resolving. Do you think that Qatar is doing enough on terror? And if so, would you like to see President Trump increase the pressure on the Saudi coalition to ease its blockade? And, Mr. President, if you would give us any more of your thinking on going forward the path with Attorney General Sessions and maybe your timeline for making a decision, that would be great. Thank you.
You don't give up. That's okay.
Thank you. I think there is an effort by the Kuwaitis. They're leading this effort, I think, and I think they made some progress. We believe that dialogue is the best way in improving this relationship between Saudi Arabia and Qatar. I believe that maybe the United States also could help in this in solving this issue in the Gulf. Denise.
one question for the President and also for Prime Minister. Congress introduced additional sanctions against Hezbollah last week. What is your position towards these sanctions and on the role of Hezbollah is playing in the region and Syria?
I'll be making my position very clear over the next 24 hours. We're going to see what is exactly taking place. I have meetings with some of my very expert military representatives and others, so I'll be making that decision very shortly. Okay?
And about his role in Syria and the region?
Whose role?
Hezbollah's role.
I'll be talking about that tomorrow.
Prime Minister, ماذا سترد الحكومة اللبنانية على طلب الكونغرس الأمريكي بشأن العقوبات على حزب الله؟
نحن لطالما تعاوننا بأي موضوع من الفرض علينا عقوبات أو على البنوك اللبنانية وتعاون بين مصرف لبنان و هذه العقوبات نحن حنستكمل يعني هذه التعاون نحن عم نقوم باتصالات بالكونغرس كمان ايضا حيكون عندي عده جولات بالكونغرس لحتى نقدر نوصل الى تفاهم بالنسبه
This is 90.9 WBUR you're listening to a joint press conference with the Prime Minister of Lebanon Saad Hariri and President Donald Trump.
Hello, Blake.
President Trump, hello. Thank you. Indulge us here for a second.
جاء أن تستمع إلينا. هل بإمكانك الشعب الأمريكي يريد أن يعرف هل تشعر بأن الموعد المدعي العام يجب عليه؟
Why should he remain as the Attorney General? And secondly, on a separate topic, with the health care vote that just came about, still a long ways to go. At what point do you feel that Republicans, if they can't get something done, should just say, you know what, we gave it a go, let's move on to tax reform instead? Thank you.
I want the Attorney General to be much tougher on the leaks from intelligence agencies, which are leaking like rarely have they ever leaked before at a very important level. These are intelligence agencies. We cannot have that happen. You know many of my views in addition to that, but I think that's one of the very important things that they have to get on with. I told you before, I'm very disappointed with the Attorney General, but we will see what happens. Time will tell. Time will tell. On health care, I'm extremely happy that we got this vote. This is, they say, if you look historically, this is the tough vote to get. Now we're all going to sit together and we're going to try and come up with something that's really spectacular. We have a lot of options and a lot of great options. And the Republican senators really went out there. It's not easy when you have 52 senators and you have a block of 48 voting against you. No matter what it is, no matter how good it sounds, it's very hard to get the kind of numbers that we got. We ended up with 51 votes, 51 to whatever. I don't know what it is. Yeah, 51 to 50. So we had two Republicans that went against us, which is very sad, I think. It's very, very sad for them. But I'm very, very happy with the result. I believe now we will, over the next week or two, come up with a plan that's going to be really, really wonderful for the American people. Obamacare is a disaster. It's failing on every front. It's too expensive. It gives horrible coverage. It was gotten by a lie 28 times. It was a lie. You can keep your doctor. You can keep your plan. All lies. And the people are sick of it. And we're going to come up with a great health care that satisfies the needs of the people that we serve, which is the people of the United States. I will say, and I said it right at the beginning, health care is always difficult because you have to weed a very, very narrow path, like a quarter of an inch wide, right down the middle. And if you go a little bit too far right, you lose three people on the left. And if you go a little bit too far left, you lose five people on the right. It is a very, very complex and difficult task. But it's something I actually know quite a bit about. I want to just thank some of the Republican senators who were really fantastic in getting us here, particularly John McCain for making the trip. But I think you're going to have a great health care This is the beginning of the end for the disaster known as Obamacare. Thank you very much.
And Mr. President.
Mr. President, how can the United States help Lebanon cope with the massive number of refugees, of Syrian refugees, and is there a way you can help facilitate the refugees' return to their home country?
Well, we are helping, and one of the things that we have made tremendous strides at is getting rid of ISIS. We have generals that don't like to talk, they like to do. And we were with General Mattis last night, and the success they've had against ISIS is extraordinary. We've made more progress in the last 4 or 5 months than previous, really, I could say the previous administration made in 8 years. And then we have to see what we have to see. But I will tell you, ISIS in Syria, ISIS in Iraq, ISIS in other locations, we have made tremendous strides. Our military is an incredible fighting force. And as you know, I let the commanders on the ground do what they had to do. Before, they used to have to call in this beautiful house and speak to people that didn't know what was happening, where they were, what locations, practically probably never heard of the countries they were talking about or the towns. I let the generals do what they had to do. And we have made tremendous plans. We were discussing it just before. We have made tremendous gains with respect to ISIS in Syria, Iraq, and other places.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Rais.
What about Bashar al-Assad in Syria? Assad? I'm not a fan of Assad, okay?
He will tell you that because we hit
58 out of 58. Or you could even say 59 out of 59 when we launched the Tomahawk missiles. No, I am not a fan of Assad. I certainly think that what he's done to that country and to humanity is horrible. So I have been saying that for a long time. I am not somebody that will stand by and let him get away with what he tried to do. And he did it a number of times when President Obama drew the red line in the sand. And then he should have crossed that red line because some horrible acts against humanity took place, including gas and the killing through gases. That was a bad day for this country. And I'd go a step further that had President Obama gone across that line and done what he should have done, I don't believe you'd have Russia, and I don't believe you'd have Iran to anywhere near the extent, and maybe not at all, in Syria today. Okay? Thank you very much.
دولتي رئيس السؤال لك كمان حكي كثير عن خفض الميزانية ميزانية الدعم الأمريكية للبنان بعد اللقاءات اللي عملتوها هل أنتم مطمئنين لاستمرار هذا الدعم خصوصي للجيش اللبناني؟
نحن مطمئنين إن شاء الله وكان في حوار واضح وصريح مع فخامة الرئيس وإن شاء الله الدعم للجيش اللبناني حيكمل مثل ما كان بإذن الله.
We're listening to a live press conference from Washington. Lebanon's Prime Minister Saad Hariri is speaking with President Donald Trump, answering questions about several things, including Syria, ISIS, terrorism, the economy, and of course the President today asked about his Attorney Jeff Sessions, his Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who he said he was disappointed in, and also asked about the health care vote in the Senate today. And it sounds as if this press conference is now wrapping up. Again, it was a press conference with Lebanon's Prime Minister Saad Hariri and President Donald Trump. They did talk about several topics, although much of the discussion during this press conference today focused on domestic issues, particularly the Senate vote that happened just before the two men spoke. The Senate voted 51 to 50, with Vice President Mike Pence breaking the tie in the Senate, and they will start debating Republican legislation to repeal and replace Obamacare. The Boston Globe's Matt Visor joined us just before the press conference started, and he's with us on the line again. Hi there, Matt. What do you make of this press conference? First of all, the fact that Lebanon's Prime Minister Saad Hariri said that this was a good meeting with President Trump, and also President Trump's comments. Of course, the big issue is Syria and the 1.5 million refugees in Lebanon from Syria, and President Trump's comments that he is not a fan of Syrian President Assad.
Yeah, he didn't articulate too much about some of the issues, but Assad was one that he seized on. You know, he's not a fan of Assad, and he pointed to the Tomahawk missiles that the United States launched on Syria, and as he often does, brought up President Obama's own reluctance to use military force on Assad, as President Trump did. He referenced Hezbollah a little bit, you know, and talked about how he'll have something more to say, which, you know, is we'll keep an eye out for in the next day or two.
Okay, and the big issues, of course, were health care and Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Let's take health care first. The vote just happened today in the Senate for the Senate to continue debating repealing and replacing Obamacare. We also had an emotional speech on the Senate floor today by Arizona Senator John McCain, who just got back and actually after his diagnosis with brain cancer and came for this particular vote. Those of us in Massachusetts may remember something similar with the late Senator Ted Kennedy. I mean, it was very emotional. What happened there, and what happens next with health care, Matt?
Well, what happened today was a motion to proceed toward debate. What happens next is a giant mystery. Over the next couple of days, there will be a lot of debate, a lot of amendments. There will be a lot of voting, trying to come up with some compromise among Republicans over whether they can agree on just a straight repeal of the Affordable Care Act. They'll probably move from that, if that fails, onto some different amendments and trying to change the House version of the legislation, which likely wouldn't pass in the Senate. And again, whatever the Senate does, if they can get 50 senators on the same page, then they still need to win over votes in the House. So depending on how much they tweak, may face opposition from their Republican colleagues on the House side. So it moved forward again today. Healthcare is not done, by any means.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Attorney General Sessions was another major topic during this press conference today between President Trump and Lebanon's prime minister. The president saying he was disappointed in the attorney general. Of course, he's said this for a while now, ever since that interview in The New York Times. But he also said that he wanted Jeff Sessions as attorney general to be tougher on leaks. What are we seeing here, do you think, Matt Visor, on the part of the president and this hostility toward his attorney general?
There's two kind of schools of thought. I mean, one is that he's laying the groundwork for firing Jeff Sessions, or at least forcing him to resign. This public criticism of one of his most loyal advisors during the campaign and one of his top cabinet members is quite striking. The other school of thought is that, he's trying to influence things that Jeff Sessions does. There's the Justice Department and, within that parameter, the investigation that is going on into Russian involvement in the election and President Trump's potential collusion with Russia on that. So I think there's a couple of things going on, but it's clear that President Trump is very frustrated by the investigation continuing and by Jeff Sessions recusing himself from that investigation because of meetings that he had had with the Russian ambassador during the campaign.
What are you hearing, though, from folks at least, speculating at this point, which I know it's speculation, but do you really think there's going to be a change at the top in the attorney general's office from all of this?
It's early to say, but it's not out of the question. I think that President Trump, once he comes to a decision, will make it fairly quickly. And I think that he could make that any moment. You know, so I do think that there is some possibility that, Jeff Sessions, something happens with him in his job. So I think that that is something that President Trump is certainly thinking about and, you know, talking about openly, which is the striking aspect of this. The question is, how far does that percolate down and affect Bob Mueller and, you know, the special counsel and
right.
his investigation, which is ongoing? And if President Trump does move to remove him, does Congress try to use its power to reinstall him?
Matt Visor, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. There's an update today on the research into a brain disease linked to football players. Researchers have found a high prevalence of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, in the brains of more than 200 players. Joining us to talk about this is WBUR sports and society reporter Shira Springer. Hi, Shira.
Hi, Deb.
So this research, which was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, looked at the brains of more than 200 former players?
Yep, 202 former players, correct.
And what'd they find?
Well, they found a prevalent, you know, they were able to diagnose CTE in 87% of those brains. And that included, out of 111 former NFL players, 110 diagnoses of CTE in those brains.
Remind us again what CTE is and what it causes.
Yeah, CTE is a degenerative brain disease that is found in people who have suffered repeated blows to the head. And the symptoms at the early stages are typically dizziness, a little attention deficit disorder, headaches. Then it progresses to memory loss, erratic behavior. And at the end stages, there's dementia and suicidality.
Mm. Now, you mentioned 202 players total, 111 in the NFL, so not all NFL players.
All but one.
But overall, of the 202, we're not just
they
talking
were not
about
all, correct,
NFL.
Correct.
So who was looked at?
So they tested a wide range from going from high school players to semi-pro players to college players to players who had competed in the Canadian Football League, which is sort of the Canadian NFL equivalent.
And so is there a common thread there, a message for all athletes who may be at risk of this brain disease if they are, in fact, in a position, in, you know, continuous positions where their heads are getting hit?
I think this basically confirms what many people know, that in contact sports where you are subject to repetitive head trauma, repetitive, you know, blows, whether it's concussion or subconcussive hits that don't quite meet the criteria of concussions, you are at risk of developing CTE and the symptoms that come along with that.
Mm-hmm. What do you think parents should take from this if their children are playing a sport that might involve repeated hits like that?
I think they should be concerned. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that this study attempts to do, and I talked to one of the co-first authors, Dr. Jesse Mez, yesterday about this study, and he said, you know, part of it is to raise awareness, and part of it also is about putting together the puzzle of who CTE affects, what the long-term effects are, who's more susceptible to CTE. So they're learning more and more about this disease. And I think parents and people who, whether they're playing, their kids are playing football, soccer, rugby, ice hockey, have to be very, very cautious and also hope that researchers are on a bit of a fast track to learning more about this disease. Sort of the holy grail of this research and what this is building toward is to be able to diagnose this in living human beings. At this point, you can only diagnose CTE post-mortem. Hmm. So they're trying to learn more, and this is a first step, a building block toward that living diagnosis, at which point you can develop treatment.
Right. Now, what about some of the other limitations of this study?
Well, I think it should be, you know, recognized that this, you know, was only a sample of football players. There were no controls. There was no control in
right.
this study. So you don't have people who didn't play football. So we don't know what the direct effect of playing football is in terms of developing CTE. Also, of, you know, the 202 brains that were studied, they were donated to this brain bank because the family members players or the athletes, the football players themselves, saw symptoms while they were living. Either they were depressed, they were disoriented, they suffered severe headaches, perhaps dementia, and they were pretty sure when they were donating these brains that there was a likelihood of seeing CTE post-mortem.
Right, right. So no control group. Okay, Shira Springer, sports and society reporter for WBUR. Shira, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.